I'm Richard Hollingham. Welcome to the Planet Earth podcast. And this time I'm in Leicester to discover how air quality is being monitored during the 2012 Olympics. Also, how small is a dwarf elephant? And how big is your water footprint?
The average for a t-shirt would be in the order of about 1,500 litres of water to produce that single garment.
The World Health Organization estimates that every year almost 2.5 million people worldwide die as a direct result of air pollution. Many more suffer respiratory problems and lung disease, which can cut life expectancy by years. In London, for instance, air quality regularly fails to meet European standards. Well, here at the University of Leicester, scientists and engineers have been developing a new scanner system to monitor urban air pollution, which they're getting ready to deploy in time for the Olympic Games. And with me outside the laboratory here, with appropriately enough a football match going on in the background, Roland Lee and Rosie Graves from the university's Earth Observation Science Group. Now, Roland, just give us a sense of what's in the air around us. We're in a semi-urban location here.
So urban environments are cleaner than they used to be, but still we have a lot of emissions that come from the traffic network in particular. We have nitrogen dioxide, we have particulate matter, and we have ozone coming out of the exhaust of cars that then we breathe in.
And what's that doing to us?
Some of it affects the airways to the lungs, so what we breathe in and our respiratory tract and the way that our body responds to that. And some of it gets into our bloodstream and actually affects the cardiovascular system and how our heart responds.
So none of that's good. Where is it all coming from?
Much of it, 95% of the nitrogen dioxide, for example, in an urban environment, comes from the vehicles, from cars, from heavy goods vehicles and from buses.
Now, pollution is already monitored. There are monitoring stations around the country, particularly in big cities. But you've developed a new type of scanner, which is here in front of us. Now, I guess it looks a bit like an oversized speed camera. Or, if you're into your television history, one of the original BBC TV cameras from the 1930s mounted on a plinth. So that means it can rotate. It's triangular, I suppose, with a hatch at one side.
We realised several years ago that we could monitor air quality using scattered sunlight. So there is a possibility to create an instrument that just receives scattered sunlight and tells you how much nitrogen dioxide there is in the air. So this instrument is designed to sit on top of a tall building and produce an image of the nitrogen dioxide over a complete urban environment, really letting you see the individual emission sources and where those pollutants end up downwind.
So does that mean you can map where these particular pollutants are, where these chemicals are in the atmosphere, rather than get a snapshot of how much there is?
Exactly, yes. Yes, with multiple instruments, you can get a 3D reconstruction of where these gas fields are. So traditional sensors take in a single point measurement. They suck in air down a tube, and they give you a very accurate point measurement that might be by a roadside. We, between two or three instruments, can map out a complete urban area and tell you where the nitrogen dioxide is in that space.
It is a curious looking machine. It's imagine around the size of a microwave oven, but a triangular microwave oven. And you look inside, it's full of circuit boards and wires. And there's a box in the middle which is covered in a silver bubble wrap. I guess that's the heart of it.
Exactly, that's the heart of the instrument. That's a spectrometer that was originally designed to be a satellite instrument for air quality mapping by Surrey Satellite Technologies. We built the first one of these spectrometers ever to be made in the world. It produces very, very nice data for exactly what we're needing here, which is air quality information in our scattered sunlight data. So we have one of those spectrometers sat in the middle of a rotating turret, collecting sunlight and mapping out the air quality.
And when you say a spectrometer, what is that actually measuring?
So the spectrometer takes in sunlight. In our case, we have filters that means it's just above UV to what is about yellow to red. And we then pull out bits of information in the blue to green bits of that light to the point where it's much more sensitive than the human eye would be to those slight subtle changes in colour. But this spectrometer can really tell us how much of a one shade of green there is. And that one shade of green is a shade that is absorbed by nitrogen dioxide. So with that real high sensitivity to these colours, you can pull out that information on the gases.
Now, Rosie, you're looking to use this during the Olympics really as a way of testing it out.
Yeah, so as part of a UK-wide project called ClearFlow, we'll be going to the Olympics in July and August this year. We'll be deploying three of the instruments on three different buildings around the city centre, to the west of the city generally, and trying to map out the pollution over the city in this quite unusual time for us. Obviously the roads will be different, there'll be a lot more people in London to normal, so it'll be quite interesting to see what happens.
So is that why you're doing it at the Olympics, when you've got this very different traffic flows and a huge number of people as well in the city?
Yeah, so it's important to know what the conditions were like during the Olympics and see how we coped with this extra traffic and things. And we also did a field campaign in January and February this year in London to see how it was before the Olympics. So then we'll be looking at what happens during the Olympics and trying to compare the two.
So Roland, how is information from this going to be used, or from other sensors going to be used? Because you can look right now on a website and see London or a lot of other cities around the country and around the world that pollution levels are being exceeded. Mm-hmm. This will again tell you that pollution levels are being exceeded.
What this instrument can do is it can map the emission source and where that emission goes downwind. Much of the information we have at the moment is from these point sources, which then are put into a model, and that model then produces a good figure that tells you what is happening over an urban environment over a year, over a month, over a week. What this instrument can do is it can say, this is, we've imaged this being emitted at point source, we've watched it go downwind, we've watched it mix, we've watched it dynamically evolve, chemically evolve, and then we've seen where it ends up. And that can happen for every single emission source, even emission sources you didn't realize were there before. So for example, here several years ago we picked up the railway station in Leicester with an early prototype of this instrument and watched trains leave the railway station, and that was quite a new bit of information for our local authority that didn't really realize how much was coming out of an individual train as it pulled out of the station and where that emission went.
Because they are quite smelly old diesel trains that go through Leicester, aren't they?
They certainly can be.
And do you think things like this will ultimately make a difference and bring down, for instance, those alarming number of deaths from urban air pollution?
We are, in fact, developing systems which take in data from this and enable the local authorities to make decisions on traffic management and air quality management at the same time. And that's where we're really trying to make a difference, where people can be informed when there's going to be poor air quality days in the future, so the local authority knows where to direct traffic, which roads to avoid, which areas have sensitized individuals. That's really where you start making a difference to people's lives and having that societal impact that we all try and achieve.
Roland Lee and Rosie Graves, thank you both very much. This is the Planet Earth podcast from the University of Leicester. And as you'd expect, we'll be putting some pictures of CityScan on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter, and do visit Planet Earth Online for news and features about the natural world. There's an awful lot that scientists can learn about the past from fossils, but one particular extinct species is proving a tough nut to crack. Dwarf elephants last roamed the Earth more than 10,000 years ago. About a metre tall, fully grown, they are even considered by some to be responsible for the legend of the one-eyed cyclops. But although they've been studied for 150 years, fundamental information about dwarf elephants is still missing, and no one's exactly sure how the different species evolved. Paleontologist Victoria Herridge from London's Natural History Museum is part of an international project trying to solve the mystery. Victoria studies dwarf elephant fossils found on a number of Mediterranean islands. Sue Nelson went to meet her in one of the museum's basement stores.
In here we have a whole drawer full of dwarf elephant teeth from Cyprus. And they're all different sizes, but most of them are smaller than the size of my hand, which sounds quite big for a tooth, but for an elephant tooth, that's absolutely tiny. So if you would look at an elephant tooth, what you see usually is a series of ridges in sequence, one after the other. We call each of those ridges a plate, and an elephant tooth is made up of several of those. They have six teeth through their life, and as the elephant grows bigger, the teeth grow bigger. So the smaller teeth are actually the teeth of younger elephants. And so these are elephants that would have died before they were fully adult. And I've got one in this other hand here, which is about golf ball size, and that would probably be, if it was equivalent to an African elephant, it would be about, say, 4 or 5 years old.
You've been studying these dwarf elephant fossils from Mediterranean islands. Are they particularly common on islands then?
You only find dwarf elephants on islands. It seems to be an island phenomena. It's not just dwarf elephants you get. You also get on, say, on Cyprus, dwarf hippopotamus. And similarly on Sicily, you get dwarf hippopotamus, dwarf deer, dwarf elephants. And also on Crete, you get dwarf hippopotamus, dwarf elephants and dwarf deer. It seems that on islands, when big animals become isolated there, they tend to evolve to become smaller. And conversely, the small animals like mice and rats